The zombie is the modern word for it, and it's a modern, I think it's a Haitian word or a West Indian word of some sort. But the idea that the soul leaves the body and goes to hell before the body does is in Dante. Mm. And it's a particularly vile thought, really, that as I said, that there are certain ways of being in the world for which it matters not whether you have a soul or not, however you define soul. I don't know if it's of interest at all, but I wrote the story after my only visit to the United States of America. I was in Rutgers in New Jersey for a semester in the cold in the winter, and what's that?
Academics.
Slightly strange, but. I suppose one of the things that strikes me, I haven't read that for ages actually, but that is more sort of, I hope it's not an allegory, but it's edging towards something which is so figurative that the sort of, it's as far away as you can get from an awful lot of contemporary fiction, which is absolutely rooted in the here and now, in the street language of here and now, in the deeply sort of remembered or recorded reality of how people actually live in immense detail, and there's some of it in that, but effectively it's pared down into a kind of fable, really.
Is there any dialogue?
Not strictly, but this is neither here nor there, but I stopped using, somewhere before Ra took me on, I stopped using speech mark so that and I did it deliberately, and partly it's just the clutter. And also I got very fed up with having to decide definitely whether this was uttered aloud or whether it was just a thought process. Yeah. And also I particularly like a narrative voice that can just drift in and out. Yeah. In either being some sort of authoritative voice or just drifting into the consciousness of the characters and eliding then to and fro, so that there's no cut-off point when the character is definitely uttering this aloud, and the narrative. I mean, it's invented by Flaubert. It's called style indirect libre, the free indirect speech, where the way of getting into one of your characters is to start. The thing that it did for me, I felt very definitely, because I'm not good at dialogue. The only voice I've got, local voice, is my mother's and grandmother's from Salford, and I've got no gift for mimicry. I've got no gift for being able to set down dialogue that sounds like real speech, really. And also, the more you actually study the dialogue in really good short stories, it is not how people speak. It's a literary equivalent of it. And as soon as you accept that what you're not there to do is minutely reproduce how people actually speak, but to get the rhythms or to find what is characteristic in it, then it frees you up enormously. Because you can then, for a start, write something that you will vouch for. You don't put all the ums and ahs in, you don't put all these ridiculous swear words in the whole time. I mean, it's just a clutter. You refine it effectively. And also, if you adopt the system or the strategy, really, of just eliding out of what people might really say and what people might really think into what a more or less omniscient narrator might think or say, then you free yourself up to say what they might say, which is really what it's all about. It's a sort of utopian vision, really, of what a person's articulacy might be like if he or she were gifted enough, which frees you up to try to say what it feels like being them. Because if you really confine yourself to what, you know, even educated people and privileged people might actually think or feel, it's terribly restricted. And fiction and poetry are there to break it open and allow people in stories and poems to have a sort of utopian utopian in the sense of a far, far greater articulacy than them, than normally speaking happens. So.
One of the first short stories in that book, I think it was about the woman with cancer and the horse.
Yeah.
I read it and then I thought, there's no dialogue in it. And then I went back through it and there was.
Yeah.
But it didn't come across stilted and separate. It was all part of the story. And I think that's why I came away from the first reading. I think there wasn't any. It was better because it wasn't.
The writers whose dialogue is absolutely stunning. I mean, there are writers who conduct the whole thing in dialogue, and they've pared it down and they can do it. And there's very little that's going on except what characters are actually saying. I'm making no pitch for this being the way to do it. I don't think there is a way to do it. I think I'm sure you found this out. Every time I sit down to do a story, I think I can do it. It's like reinventing the wheel. I don't know how to do it. The criteria for doing it come with the with the particular project. But, it's a very strange business. The idea that once you know you kind of got it, then you just repeat it. It follows basically. I mean, you don't. You can't. I mean, you start again in lots of ways. It's true. You get. I mean, the decision not to, I mean, I even go back on it, but the decision not to use speech marks, I felt, freed me up. Also, I have a horror of pluperfect tenses. And I don't like it if I find myself proceeding into a story and then thinking, oh God, I've got to say what happened before. You know, and then you're into the pluperfect tense, and then you think, well, if I start using the pluperfect tense for more than three sentences, I think this is just, it's just... And you get into explanations, you know, and you think, I can't go on because they won't know what I mean unless I explain that, you know, they used to be married before in Singapore, and, you know, and then you get this... and then you get back to where you were, and they say, now we've got all this, now you can... so, it's a very strange business.
So David, when you say you often begin a story without a notion of where it's going, but because you hear voices, which, is familiar and fascinating. It's not so much voice in dialogue, it's the voice of the story.
It's the voice of the story, and it's a tone of voice, really.
Yeah,
and that comes with that comes with the kind of characters that are going to be in it. It's an ethos, it's tone of voice, really. Just tiny bits of dialogue, big things that you know you like, so they might really...
Fragments.
Right,
yeah.
They're fragments.
Yeah.
So what was the starting point for that story? Was it Dante?
It's really Dante it wouldn't matter whether it was Dante or not. It's just the idea that, which had been brought home to me quite forcibly, of people living... Well, I'm not, you know, I'm an atheist, but I believe that there's, I don't know whatever you're going to call it, that there's some... thing that without which you are effectively the living dead, you know? And it has to do with the degree of, I don't know, engagement in what you do.
I meet a lot of people like that, especially on Monday morning.
It does as well. I really struck actually people who are doing their jobs, going home, doing that, and there's nothing but that.
You can hear. That's not in that story, but you can hear it. There was a guy, I don't know his name, it's not necessary, but he was explaining why BlackBerry wasn't working. I haven't got one, I don't want one, but clearly this was the worst thing that could possibly happen to the universe. And he was being interviewed, and I listened very carefully. He used no words properly. There were no words that meant anything.
That's in PR.
But none of them meant anything.
Yeah.
And he just kept saying, there's an issue. And when he'd gone off the air, James Naughtie, who was the judge of the short stories, said, so now I know that when my boiler blows up and doesn't work anymore, it's not that it's blown up and doesn't work anymore, it's that it has an issue. My boiler has an issue. No, it's not just blown up.
Actually,
it was absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, you're dead right.
There were no words.
An issue.
And he went on and on about it. About
an issue. Yeah.
And none of it. It's all common.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You probably said as well.
Well, he didn't quite say it was about customers. You
know, he didn't complete a sentence, did he?
No, he couldn't.
He had a sort of splurge of words, and then he tried to think of another way of trying to express what he was trying to say.
Another very salutary interview was half an hour with Blair talking about the war on terror, which was absolutely extraordinary. Because not James Naughtie, but the other...
John Humphreys
kept saying, you use this phrase. And Blair actually said... He said, it almost does not matter what words you use. This is the man who's in charge of our lives. It almost does not matter what words you use. Gosh. That is all well, it's all the rest of it there in a nutshell. If you know, that's coming back to this thing about a utopian language. It's your duty as writers to keep sort of up in the stakes, really, to enable people into speech which is actually exact. Because all the gobshite you hear day in, day out, whether it's willful or not, is a more or less willful cretinisation of the entire population if they could do it. And you're at the mercy of all this. And the guy was in hell. I mean, the Blackberry man is in hell, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, just, you know, this goes back to 1960s existentialism. You are where you are. And he was in hell. You don't need any closer definition. Anybody who can go on public radio and talk for 50 minutes and not use one word, you know.
He wasn't looking forward to it, I can tell you.
It sounded like an out of body. He had responded. Yeah, it's just his.
Who can we get to go out and talk for this?
One of the ideas in your story, which was that the more successful you are, the less likely you are to have a soul. Although you're an atheist, and I am too, that's quite similar to the sort of Christian idea of the meek shall inherit the earth and all that.
Yeah.
Hardship, you know, somehow makes
you a better person. What shall it profit a man if he loses his immortal soul? I mean, it's laying up riches, and what shall it profit a man if he... But that's why the New Testament is so absolutely vital, because it's full of ways of living badly and possibilities of living well. Copies.
Did you start with Dante and move away from
it? It's just the idea that I was familiar with from Dante, but it's a more general worry about occupations, really. And it's wrong to feel. I mean, it's, you know, there are occupations which it's an immense privilege to have anything to do with, and if you lose your soul in that, it's your own fault. There are other occupations where it is almost de rigueur that you don't have a soul because you wouldn't get the job in the first place.
Yeah.
You're not tempted to put him back on the path that he lost.
I wouldn't know how to do it. I mean, that's why they're so...
You're happy to leave him in hell?
Yeah, because I think another general principle is that it's not up to you to sort of make people feel okay. Because things aren't okay. And it's not up to you to, you know, tidy things up into a happy ending or anything like that. Clearly it's not. And that's just, it's a very, very narrow exercise in what it might feel like if you... But I mean, I suppose that's one of the things that people worry about sometimes with writing, is it, you know, what I to say on the one hand this, on the other hand that? Absolutely not. You follow, there's one possibility, and it's an absolutely lethal possibility, and it's your duty to follow that through. It doesn't, that's not how the world is, that's one possibility. But nobody's going to write a story or a novel which tells you how the world is. They're just glimpses, really.
I love the stories of yours I've read so far, David, the way in which you place them quite often almost at the cusp between life and death. There's big stuff there, you know, of soul or essence, and you know, there's the story at the beginning of The Shealing with, you know, the boy watching the body.
I was tempted to read that.
You know, extraordinary. Well, this is an extraordinary story, but there's big metaphysical stuff, but it's not just metaphysical. You know, you make it very grounded. You put it in the stuff.
Well, it depends how much more. I'd quite like to read that one, because the first time I knew, I don't know what anybody else's practice is, but I started keeping a journal, a writerly journal at the age of 15, which was And it is terrible. I mean, it's the worst thing is I haven't actually been able to throw it away. It's so awful. But there's one thing in it, which is where that started. The only piece of writing in it is the description.
Really? Going back that far?
Which I lifted out of a notebook from when I was 16.
Really? So that is from your notebook? I wondered that just because it felt so remarkably absurd. Sort of,
that was the time when I knew I had to do it, really.
Yeah, it was incredibly vivid,
Take 10 minutes?
Yeah.
I'd love to.
Yeah, please. Yes, please.